You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 78 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
We have a lot to get to, but first and foremost, I think we should welcome, if there are any new listeners from the Shea Serrano podcast that we had earlier this week. If you missed that one, you should go back and listen to it right now. We'll stop. We'll wait. You should go back and listen to Shea because it was excellent.
I don't know if you should stop and listen to it. This one is more time sensitive than the Shea podcast is, but it was a classic without question.
Legendary podcast.
Yeah.
One of the favorites that we've ever recorded. But also, you shouldn't only go back and listen to that one, because you should also check out the Rap Yearbook pod that we kind of buried right there beneath our Shea Serrano interview, because I think that was a good one too.
So much hashtag content from us this week, and that's important because there are almost no podcasts out there right now.
Yes, that's a good
Very
thing.
Very few podcasts.
That's a good thing. But let's get to what we're drinking this week, because we have a lot of toast to have.
We do. We are drinking the Rogue Pumpkin Patch Ale brewed with Rogue Farms pumpkins. Created with pumpkins grown at Rogue Farms in Independence, Oregon, fresh pumpkins are picked, loaded into our truck, driven immediately 77 miles west to our brewery in Newport, Oregon, quickly roasted and pitched into the brew kettle. And this is brewed using 15 ingredients.
Rogue Farms. Sounds like it's mostly only pumpkins, though.
Rogue Farms Dream Pumpkins, Rogue Farms Dare, Risk, Carafa, and Crystal Wheat Malts, Rogue Farms Independent Hops, Orange Peel, Cinnamon, Cloves, Cardamom, which sounds like a reality TV series.
You don't know what cardamom is?
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, it's an excellent ice cream flavor. It's like a spice.
Huh, I wasn't aware of that. Vanilla, ginger, and nutmeg. Free-range coastal water. That's very Portlandia. And Pac-Man yeast.
So Pac-Man yeast?
Have we had the pumpkin patch ale before?
We might have.
I feel like we might have at some point, but I can't specifically remember having it. So let's crack this open.
I'm excited to have this. It's very orange. I thought you listing off the ingredients was going to be boring, but I actually kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Especially the, like, what was the free-range ocean water?
Yes. Free-range coastal water.
Free-range coastal water.
No, you don't
instead
wanna,
of the contained coastal
you
water.
You caged the coastal water. You know, yeah, it's cruel to it. It's unfair. All right, go ahead and pour this, and we'll give it a try. I thought it was nice and appropriate to have something from Rogue, since I want to talk in a little bit about my trip down to Portland yesterday for the first time this season for Blazers opening night. But first, we have to toast to something crucial. It was 1 year ago Friday that the Pelton cast returned from its 32-month hibernation
and
came back to the airwaves. So we are hitting the one-year anniversary mark of being back, and it has been a fine year.
Oh, one of the best years we've ever had.
That's true. That is absolutely true.
I think I wish I should have brought up this tweet exactly, but I think it was our friend Lionbutt the Third on Twitter who, when we came back, said that he was very thankful that we'd reconciled our relationship to bring this podcast back. We were feuding for those, how many months? 18 months?
No, 32.
We're also feuding about how many months it was. It was, I think it was anywhere between 18 and 60 months.
We're feuding about my ability to correctly do math and your ability to incorrectly do math.
But Lionbutt the Third thanking us for reconciling our relationship and bringing the Pelton cast back. It's been an excellent year, but we should toast to all of the great content that we put out, everybody who's been, all the Third Pelton brothers.
So many Third Pelton brothers. And I would say most of all, to the listener.
To the listener.
The listener has been loyal.
Thank you. Thank you for your reviews on iTunes, of which you haven't left that many of. Thank you for downloading the podcast. Thank you for coming to our live show.
Right.
Thank you for coming to Trivia. This is something that all of these things we didn't think were going to happen.
We didn't expect to have hats.
Yeah. And at some point, we'll explain to you how you can get a hat.
Well,
but
we're not sure.
We have no
That's
idea.
That's the important thing.
All we know is that anytime that you and I are together, we're wearing the same hat now.
That is correct.
Okay, but I had one more thing that I want to toast.
Oh, what's that?
With my other beer.
Oh, yes. Your side beer tonight.
Side
the
beer tonight.
The same thing we were drinking on the the return of the Pelton cast a year ago.
That is a Rainier beer in a Winter Jubilee can. Somebody, who was it? Aaron Robertson, who tweeted us that they were drinking their first Jubilee can of the year, and it looked so good.
It did.
And I said I had to go out and get one of those immediately. But also, we don't just have to toast to the Jubilee can. We also have to toast our day. We missed it last year, but this Saturday, we celebrated our day in Seattle, the anniversary of when the Rainier R reclaimed its throne atop the Rainier Brewery.
I think that was a staple of like one of the very first Pelton cast episodes, if I recall correctly.
Oh yeah, celebrating the Rainier R coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a very important Pelton cast moment, to be sure.
Well, happy R Day to you.
Happy R Day to you as well.
But going back to this beer that we're drinking, and going down to our neighbors in the state of Oregon. You recently went down to Portland to go see the Blazers, but also took in some eats.
Yeah, I went down early specifically so that I could go eat. Sadly, Stanich's, which you'll recall when we did our episode with Kevin Alexander from Thrillist earlier this year, was his number one burger in the country.
Number one burger in the country.
I'm so excited to try it. Sadly, it's closed on Tuesday, so I wasn't able to go there. Instead, I went to one of the hottest burger places in Portland, and that's a food truck called Burger Stevens, highly recommended to me by my friend Eric Gunderson down there in Portland. And so what it is, it's a chef who previously worked at like Michelin star rated restaurants and then decided
this is what happens in Portland.
It is. And then decided to try to perfect the burger out at this food truck that's not really, it's in the city of Portland, but it's more of a like neighborhood, like a residential neighborhood part of Portland. I would compare it kind of to like having a burger place in Wallingford.
Okay.
Kind of. So
that's still Seattle. I mean, you need a burgers in Wallingford.
You need a burgers in Fremont.
Oh, it's in Fremont, yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit away from downtown. So I made the drive out there on Tuesday, and I would have to say it was a more flavorful patty than any we
really
had in the search for Seattle's best burger.
Really?
Yeah, it was an incredibly flavorful patty. Great cheese as well, complimenting it. I could have used more sauce. I almost always can use more sauce, so I think I'm going to ask for that if I go back or the
extra
next
sauce.
Time. But a very worthy competitor, I would say one that I would probably rank somewhere around fifth or sixth.
Really? Only fifth or sixth?
Yeah, I mean, with the potential to move up, you know, with the sauce, if I got more of that. I mean, I think it could be competitive with the best. You know, it's kind of a little smaller burger, thinner
patty.
Was
it $26?
It was not $26. Okay. I think the burger itself is like $8, maybe.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'll allow that.
Yeah, not a bad deal at all.
What is the new burger place in Seattle that also originated in Portland?
I've forgotten the name of that. You're talking about Happy Grillmore, aren't you?
Happy Grillmore.
Yes. Which was a food truck originally in Portland. Then I think in like 2012, it moved to Seattle and has been operating for a truck for a long period of time. But now they have opened a brick and mortar establishment in Capitol Hill.
I'm very excited to try that.
You are.
You're not excited?
I am excited, but I'm not as excited as you are.
I mean,
you're
I'm always just excited to eat burgers. They're great.
I was listening back to the first episode we did when we came back last year, and you made a comment about like forcing me to eat Seattle's best burgers, and lo and behold, that came very true.
And I implied that you wouldn't be into it.
Yeah, I don't know. That was very confusing.
Did you not like burgers a year ago?
No, I think I liked burgers about equally.
Equally?
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on Portland? Did you have any thoughts on the Blazers for your trip?
So they won their 17th consecutive home opener.
Nice.
I've been there now. This is 10 years that I have been going to Blazers opening night since the Sonics move, and they have won all of those, obviously, plus seven more.
Wow.
Which is I mean, 17 years in a row to do something is a long time to do almost anything.
That's kind of amazing.
It is, yeah.
Also, they started out with how many road games?
Three.
Wow.
Yeah, not a huge number, but more than in past seasons where they've typically opened the season at home. And that takes a little bit of the excitement out of it, I will admit. But the streak was in some jeopardy. DeMarcus Cousins went off in this game with Anthony Davis leaving with a sore knee. But the Blazers got enough scoring down the stretch from CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard to pull away and get the victory and
nice.
Go to
17 in a row.
Yeah.
You don't want to be on the team that breaks that streak.
No. You don't want to let that one go. So I think that's it for now. Obviously, there will be many more Portland trips in the future. A loyal listener, Rob Haley, tipped me off to the fact that there's a Burmese food truck in Portland.
Oh, really?
So I think that might be my next stop. That's,
I mean, there's basically not Burmese food in the entire state of Washington.
I mean, maybe somewhere in the state of Washington there is, but
there's definitely not Burmese food in the greater Seattle area.
Yeah.
So this Burmese food truck is very interesting.
As we discussed, of course, on the podcast with Rich Cho, the Peltoncast special.
Oh, I'm more fascinated to hear about that than I am about Stanish's.
Interesting.
I think I know that Stanish's is overrated.
I don't know. I mean, it came in a solid, I think we were passing around, there was a ranking of Portland's 50 best burgers,
okay,
which is an incredible number of burgers to rank. I they weren't all ranked. I think they were, some of them were just like listed at some point, but a lot to try at least. And Burger Stevens came in number two, which is, I don't think I ever said that was the name of the food truck I went to.
You did.
I did. Okay. And then Stanish's, I believe, came in number three on that list.
The number one burger in the country. Like, there is no way that it's not overrated.
Well, yes. And, like, Loretta's is overrated from that standpoint.
You'd have to eat it, and it would have to be the best burger you have ever had in your entire life.
That's true.
Save for when you've traveled to other countries.
I've eaten a lot of burgers abroad.
Right? So this would, you would have to eat it, and it would have to be unequivocally the greatest burger you've ever had.
It would have to be life-changing.
And so it can't meet those expectations.
That's all very fair. All right, should we move on to talking about the Seattle arena situation and the possibility that someday we can end the streak of me having to drive down to Portland for games?
Yeah, was there any progress in the last week?
No, not really any progress. An interesting event coming up this Saturday, the Oakview Group is hosting a Seattle Center Arena design open house at Cornish Playhouse on the Seattle Center campus. That's going from 10 to 2 on Saturday, which they probably assumed would be a fine time, but it turned out that the Huskies are actually playing a day game against UCLA. So anyone who's going to that game, as we are, will be unable to attend this open house. But if you're not going to the UW game, we'll link in the post notes the link to RSVP to attend that open house and potentially weigh in on the design.
Okay.
Also, another mayoral debate this week hosted by King Five, and as always, the two mayoral candidates asked their positions on the arena, and it seems like every time they deliver slightly different comments about the arena. This time, Carrie Moon said, you know, again expressed her support for making the Key Arena renovation the first priority. She said, this time, though, she came up with a slightly different critique. In the past, she's talked about the concern of Live Nation dominating the local concert market. This time said, I haven't seen that the proponent has put in enough money to really make the transit solution work, so I would keep pushing on that to try to make the Coliseum work at Seattle Center. She also notably expressed opposition to an entertainment district in SoTo around an arena there. You know,
Why?
Because she's concerned about the effect that it would have on the industrial land there. So if there isn't an entertainment district there, the arena really is no longer viable at that point, because that's part of kind of the business proposition.
Okay. So Carrie Moon, between the two candidates right now, Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon, Carrie Moon has been the more pro Key Arena candidate so far.
Yes, and Jenny Durkin, by contrast, like, went out of her way to express her neutrality, described it as yes, virulent neutrality. She also notably came in just to say, and this is how weird Seattle politics are, she wanted to make note, I hate the Thunder.
Great. Like, what does that amount to?
I mean, you know, sometimes you just got to get that off your chest, I guess.
You hate the Thunder? Like, there's some people out there who don't hate the Thunder enough. They might have to learn a thing or two from Jenny Durkin.
Did you see also that Duff McKagan has weighed in on the arena debate?
Yes, finally.
Mentioned he went to a Cavaliers game and how much he wants the Sonics back, and said he favors the SoTo solution.
Okay, good.
So there you go.
Well, he's friends with Pearl Jam, right?
Presumably.
We would assume. Well, it's good to know that Guns N' Roses is on the SoTo side.
I think Axl is next to Wayne on this one.
Yes. Duff McKagan has 1 million followers on Twitter.
Really?
Yeah, that's unbelievable, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's basically like...
That is way more than you.
That is a lot more than me. He's basically a professional Seattle sports fan at this point, I think. He's like done... He's blogged.
I mean, that is more than a lot of musicians who are a lot more famous than Duff McKagan.
Yeah. Good for Duff.
So, I mean, that's a lot of people seeing... And these are obviously people throughout the entire world. But seeing conversation about the SoTo Arena is kind of amazing.
Yep. Yeah, that is true. So that's pretty much it on the arena front. We'll see if anything more comes up. Obviously, the election, the mayoral election, is coming up here in a couple of weeks. So, you know, we'll see how that shapes this discussion.
But there's really no clear cut going into this election. This person is pro one option. This person is pro another option.
I mean, Carrie Moon is much more clearly in favor of the Key Arena renovation. So, I mean, I think, you know, therefore, by default, if you're in favor of the Soto option, that Jenny Durkin is the stronger candidate, you know, from that perspective.
There's a chance.
Yes.
So then, speaking of teams who play already in Soto, the Sounders finally, and this is another thing to toast, the MLS regular season is over.
I know, it's amazing. It seemed like it would never happen, but it came to a conclusion with decision day on Sunday. The Sounders hosting the Colorado Rapids and came up with a 3-0 victory against
nice.
Them to clinch the number 2 spot in the Western Conference and a first round bye to the conference semifinals, which is particularly crucial for a Sounders team that continues to nurse several injuries. Jordan Morris with his hamstring hasn't played in a month and a half at this point. Osvaldo Alonso with his quad injury. And then Victor Rodriguez missed the game on Sunday against Colorado with a quad injury of his own. Sounders still had plenty of firepower, despite the fact that Clint Dempsey got red carded and sent off in the first half of this match, which is doubly bad because it means that he will be suspended for the opening leg of their playoff series, which we learned Wednesday night will be against the Cascadia rival, Vancouver Whitecaps.
Oh, and so he's going to miss the match in Vancouver?
That's correct.
Great.
So the Cascadia teams, the Timbers beat Vancouver in their game that was going on opposite the Sounders match on Sunday to claim the number 1 seed in the Western Conference. And that dropped Vancouver, which had been leading the conference for a long period of time, down to 3, forced them to play in the knockout round. They defeated San Jose in the knockout round to advance. And so that means that, you know, potentially it could be three of the final 4 teams in the West will be from the Cascadia region.
Nice.
And it could be potentially, you know, whichever, if Portland wins in the other semifinal, it could be an all Cascadia Western Conference finals.
Wow.
And you could potentially have to face both Vancouver and Portland if the Sounders are to advance en route to potentially getting to the MLS Cup, where the Sounders are the favorite to get, according to 538's Soccer Power Index projections.
Really?
And the really stunning thing here is that
in the West.
Well, they're
the favorites to the Cup.
Well, here's the thing is, they are actually given the best chance of any team of getting to MLS Cup. Better than Toronto FC, whose actual Radiant Soccer Power Index is a full 7 points higher, which is equivalent to the difference between the Sounders and, you know, basically the second worst team to make the playoffs.
So they just have a harder path there.
Yeah, the Eastern Conference is much better than the Western Conference. 3 of the top 4 teams in SPI are in the East, and then also the bracket sets up much worse because it turns out that Vancouver actually has the second lowest rating now, with San Jose was the only team that was lower, now having eliminated them. Vancouver, despite their 4-0 or 5-0 win, I should say, over San Jose on Wednesday night.
5-0.
Yeah, they really poured it on after
nice.
Halftime. Probably their best performance of the season, quite frankly, has the lowest rating of any team still remaining in the playoffs by a wide margin.
Interesting.
So it actually worked out quite well. If Vancouver had lost, then because the Sounders faced the best of the remaining teams is the number 2 seed, the Sounders then would have faced the winner of the matchup between Sporting Kansas City and Houston. And both of those teams are much better by SPI. And pretty much all the advanced metrics. So
it's kind of like in the NFL, where a lot of times the division winner is worse than the top
right.
wildcard team. So you're cheering for the division winner if you have them, if you're waiting for them in the next round.
Right. Even though in this case there was no structural reason, it was just because of the fact that Vancouver had outperformed its underlying results in terms of the points they won this season and nearly won the conference because of it. So 3 matches head-to-head between the Sounders and Vancouver this season, 2 of them north of the border, and Vancouver had a win and a draw in those games, Freddie Montero scoring in both of them, and then the Sounders got a win 3-0 over the Whitecaps at home in the one game they hosted. So
without Jordan Morris, or without probably Jordan Morris and without Clint Dempsey, you know, you're going to really, if the Sounders get a goal in the first leg, that's a strong result,
yes,
pretty much, because the MLS is using the away goals tiebreaker in the two-game aggregate series. So for those of you who are perhaps are new to MLS and their playoff format, the teams play one game in each location, and whoever has the higher combined score wins. But if there's a draw, which obviously happens a lot of the time, if one team has a higher score in their away match, then that team ends up advancing, which is intended to encourage teams to play aggressively on the road and not just sit back very defensively and try to get a draw.
Interesting. I didn't know that was why.
Yeah.
I guess I never really thought about that. But so they're going to be playing Vancouver, who are playing their second match of the week with 3 days rest.
Let's see.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday rest.
Yes. Yeah. Because this game, the first leg will be Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Good time to avoid the Seahawks game on Sunday. And then the return leg, instead of being played, as it typically would on Sunday, because there's a Seahawks game at CenturyLink Field, they'll play that on Thursday night, the return leg in this matchup.
Oh, really? Thursday night? Interesting. But so this might be the type of thing where even if it's 1-0, we shouldn't panic.
No, 1-0 is not a bad result.
The Sounders can lose this match.
I mean, it's not a good result. But
it's a fine result.
2-1 is really, like, that's not a bad result, because you at least got that. Then you come home and you can win 1-0 in advance on that.
Well, yeah, yes. 2-1 is great. 1-1 is great. But especially looking at, because if it's 1-1, then you can draw at home and you're good.
Yes.
Well, you could draw 0-0 at home. But looking at the matches that they played throughout the year, they've played very tough matches. I think that the second one, the draw that they had in Vancouver this summer, was a bit of a disappointing match for the Sounders. But seeing that they won 3-0 at home, they can come back home and without much of a buffer and still win the series.
And so, you know, the thing with the Sounders all year long, we've been talking about their great expected goals and expected goal differential. And finally, in the last few weeks of the season, it seems like that's actually translated to the results in terms of the goals the Sounders have scored. The floodgates opened at home, I would say. They had the big win in their last home match before the international break, and then two big wins in their last two matches of the season over the last 2 weeks. So, you know, they've put a lot of goals on the board despite playing most of those matches, all of those matches without Jordan Morris. And then, you know, Dempsey, I think they scored 2 goals after he was red carded on Sunday. So
the goals went from being expected to actually happening.
Exactly. Which is what you would anticipate will happen over time, but there's not always enough time for those things to even out over the course of even the extremely long MLS season.
And would hope that they continue throughout the playoffs.
So the other thing this means is the Sounders matching up with a franchise icon, Freddy Montero, the all-time leading goal scorer still in MLS play, because Clint Dempsey didn't get a goal in the last two matches after the international break. And Montero had 13 goals this season as he returned to MLS with the Whitecaps, more than any Sounders player. Dempsey finished with 12. So
he's still good.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely the guy you need to be worried about, although they got 4 goals from other players against San Jose. Again, the floodgates really, really opened after, you know, San Jose was desperately trying to get back into the game, get some goals that they needed. So there you go. We'll know a lot more about where the Sounders stand this time next week.
I just can't believe that it's the playoffs, finally.
I mean, you can tell, like, once you've gone all the way through spring and summer, and then you get to fall, and, like, the midpoint of fall, then, finally,
you start to notice that you're growing older. You notice that you have a lot more wrinkles and many more children. Yeah. Then finally, it's the MLS playoffs.
It would be great if your youngest child had, in fact, been born over the course of the MLS regular season. But sadly, that is not quite the case. He'd slightly beat the MLS regular season.
So he's old. And then what about the Huskies trying to bounce back after their loss in the desert 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I don't know if it was good timing or bad timing for the Huskies to have a bye after that loss at Arizona State. It was a couple weeks to really stew on that performance. The reason it was definitely good timing, of course, is because of the fact that they had a couple of major injuries in that game.
And those people are still injured.
They're out for the season.
Yeah. So what does it matter?
Well, the point is that you've got a couple weeks to get the replacement.
Okay. All right.
At left tackle, Adam Jude of the Seattle Times reported that Andrew Kirkland and then freshman Luke Wattenberg will split snaps in place of Trey Adams. That's a little bit surprising, I think, given that Kirkland is a senior, was a guy who started last season. You would have expected him to kind of just slide naturally in that position. But apparently they want to get Wattenberg some action as kind of a long-term option at that position. And then at cornerback, we still haven't really heard who's going to replace Jordan Miller, who was injured at the very tail end of that Arizona State game. I suppose there is some chance that Byron Murphy could be back in the lineup after he's been dealing with the broken bone in his foot, which thrust Austin Joyner into the starting lineup, where he's played quite well in one of those outside cornerback slots. So, you know, if and when he gets back, I think you feel pretty good about the cornerback position.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're getting awfully inexperienced, whether it's Jamon Dotson or one of the freshmen that slide in place of Jordan Miller, who was already young himself but was playing quite well.
There may reach a point where the Huskies don't just have an endless stream of excellent young cornerbacks.
Eventually we may find that point. We haven't yet. And they will be tested this week, because we know one thing is that UCLA is going to throw the football with Chosen Rosen, Josh Rosen, at quarterback. So it's been, I would say, a disappointing season so far for UCLA, mostly on the road. They're 4-0 at home, although that did take the huge comeback to beat Texas A&M in their season opener. But they are 0-3 so far this season on the road, having lost at Memphis, at Stanford, no shame in that, and then lost quite badly at Arizona. And the reason for that primarily can be traced to their defense, which historically has been a strength under Jim Moore. You've had a lot of great individual talents. This season, they rank 88th in football power index efficiency on the defensive end and the side of the football. And that they've actually been quite good in terms of pass defense. Their opponents are allowing completing 53.5% of their passes, which is the lowest mark in the Pac-12. But the problem is that UCLA has been absolutely destroyed on the ground.
How bad could they be? My God.
How bad could they be? They have allowed an NCAA worst 303.4 rushing yards per game. You want to know how bad that is?
Oh, my God.
The Huskies have played 4 Pac-12 games so far. They have allowed a total of 241 yards, which is less than UCLA allows in the average game.
Wow.
They gave up, they're allowing 6.1 yards per carry, which is second. It's not the worst in the country. It's only second worst ahead of Air Force.
Okay.
They gave up 263 yards.
You would think Air Force would be able to defend the run.
Yeah, you would think. Gave up 263 yards on 30 carries to Bryce Love, which actually is in fact a little below his average yards per carry, but that's a lot of yards and a lot of carries. And then most recently gave up 230 yards on 15 carries to Arizona quarterback Khalil Tate, who has been just destroying everything in his path thus far.
You're saying we're going to see scrambling Jake Browning?
I am not saying that. I don't think he's Khalil Tate in terms of his skill set. They did do a little bit better last week as they beat Oregon, held that rushy attack in check, aided by the fact that Oregon doesn't really have much of a pass threat.
Unable to pass the ball.
But I think the interesting thing here is, you know, Rosen came into the season as a Heisman candidate, a lot of talk about his draft stock, and he hasn't really lived up to that level of performance thus far, despite the fact that he actually leads the Pac-12 with 8.3 yards per attempt. He still ranks 39th in QBR, one spot behind Manny Wilkins of Arizona State, the quarterback who beat the Huskies 2 weeks ago, albeit not with a dominant offensive performance. So why does he not rate as well as QBR as he does in terms of yards per attempt? Well, first off, he's thrown 8 picks in 350 attempts. You compare that to Jake Browning, who's thrown 3 interceptions in 203 attempts. And then he also just doesn't contribute as much in terms of rushing value as the other the three quarterbacks in the Pac-12 who rate ahead of him in QBR, those being the aforementioned Wilkins, Jake Browning, and then Sam Darnold from USC.
See the rushing value of Jake Browning?
I mean, he's not Khalil Tate. Khalil Tate is like the greatest rushing quarterback in college football history. He ran for 100 plus yards in 3 consecutive halves. Not games, halves. Khalil Tate is off the charts.
Wow, I really hope we do not
so
have to play
Khalil
him.
Tate on one side. Josh Rosen on the other side. And then somewhere probably a little closer to the Josh Rosen side than the Khalil Tate side is Jake Browning. That's how I'd put it. They have three receivers so far this year with at least 490 receiving yards. So they've got a lot of depth in terms of their targets. Darren Andrews has been the primary target. He's got 49 catches for 634 yards and a Pac-12 high 8 touchdowns. Also of note about the defense for UCLA, they really have struggled to force turnovers. They're forcing only one turnover per game, which is the fewest in the Pac-12. You combine that with UW's ability to take care of the football, it seems unlikely we're going to see a lot of UCLA turnovers, UCLA forcing turnovers at least. So, you know, it looks like a favorable matchup for the Huskies. They've got, you know, unless something goes horribly wrong with that cornerback spot replacing Jordan Miller, a defense that is well-equipped to deal with what UCLA does well, and an offense that has not been great running the football, but still should be able to take advantage of this weakness.
I mean, this is the week. This is the week that the run game needs to get going.
You would think so.
And everything is setting up for them perfectly. Being without Trey Adams is an issue, but they've had 2 weeks. Andrew Kirkland is very experienced. This two-headed rushing attack needs to get going. But to me, the thing that I think will really open it up is the third head of the rushing attack.
Savon Ahmed?
Savon Ahmed. Chris Peterson finally, after many weeks of people demanding it, has said that they're going to look to Savon Ahmed a little bit more in the offense, try to get him the ball, because when he gets the ball, he is explosive.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that was an issue when you were blowing out Oregon State and Cal, but when the offense did kind of grind to a halt.
And he had a long touchdown that was
called back due to a holding penalty. Yeah, I mean, he averaged, I think, 11.5 yards on his two carries in that game, so you would like to see him get involved.
But I mean, we'll see exactly how they do it. If it ends up being fly sweeps, whatever that looks like, anything that's going to keep the defense a little bit on edge if he's in there, even if there's a fake fly sweep and they're getting the ball to Miles Gaskin and to LaVon Coleman, everybody is going to look better.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
This is the game when the offense should look really good and in sync. And I think it's something that we've kind of been waiting for from this offense all year. They've had some good games against some weaker opponents, but I think this is the week where they need to put up 40-plus points, and they need to look good doing it.
I don't know if they need to put up 40-plus points, especially if you are running the ball so well that it can be a slow-paced game.
Look, if they don't gain 300 yards on the ground, I'm going to be disappointed.
I mean, I'd be content with a couple hundred. I'd be fine. I could do with that.
How do we also pay attention to the Seahawks and have this conversation?
I know.
I'm like, if they get positive yardage, I feel good.
The standards are a little different in the NFL. There's not anybody, very few players have 30 carries for 263 yards in the NFL, and almost never do quarterbacks have 15 carries for 230 yards. Really doesn't happen that often. Although, perhaps this week. Chances of victory?
I think the FBI chances are a little bit high.
Yeah, they give UW a 91% chance of winning, which is very optimistic.
This is still probably an above-average Pac-12 team. I think that the Huskies will win, and I think the Huskies will win comfortably, but 91% feels way too high. To me, it's closer to like 75%.
The 17-point line implies somewhere around 85% chances is what the gamblers are giving UW. I would say about 80% going into this one. I mean, it's a game you definitely should win, but would I be stunned if the Huskies lost it? No, UCLA has a ton of talent. They just haven't really been able to put it together, particularly on the road.
And I guess I'm fascinated to see how the secondary does. I feel pretty confident in them, though. I mean, there hasn't been a game that we've gone into, a Husky game that we've gone into, and said we're nervous about this passing attack against the Husky secondary.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true.
In the last three seasons, at least.
I mean, in the last three seasons?
Yeah.
I think there were some games you probably should have been scared at times. I guess Marcus Mariota wasn't at Oregon within the last three seasons, but still. You know, it was an interesting point that came up this week is that, you know, the Huskies basically haven't been tested deep. I think that might have been Coach K who pointed that out, Pete Kwiatkowski. And it seems like teams have almost been scared to throw
the offensive coordinator pointed it out.
Jonathan Smith is.
Oh, okay. Just edit that out.
I'm not going to. That's way too much work. This may be the week that they get tested deep, and we'll see if they're equal to the task. I suspect that, you know, certainly Austin Joyner is. Miles Bryant has been great in the slot where tackling is prioritized more a little bit over coverage. We'll see about that other spot.
I would go ahead and welcome UCLA to test the Huskies deep.
Okay.
I feel confident in that one. Do you have any grievances?
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
So my grievance is,
I have no grievances. I'm very curious to hear what yours are.
Just like completely content with life. Yeah, I had to think about it a bit.
I mean, I've got some grievances, but they're not Pulton Cast related.
Okay. My grievance is just the fact that this is now 10 seasons without the NBA in Seattle, which is 10 seasons too many to not have this NBA in a market that is one of the fastest growing in the country. It's thriving economically right now. There's a tremendous amount of wealth of people, young wealth of people, the exact demographic that the NBA is looking for. The fact that it's a city that has supported the NBA as well as Seattle has in the past, a city that still loves the Sonics tremendously. And for it to have gone this long without a team, I mean, it's just depressing is the only way to say it. I mean, I don't see how you can possibly not be aggrieved about the fact that Seattle is still without an NBA team.
Yeah. I think everybody is.
Yeah.
But the bigger issue is not just that it has been 10 seasons without an NBA team. It's that there's nothing directly on the horizon. I mean, there's progress with regards to an arena, but it could still be, there could be an arena and multiple seasons after that before there's an NBA team in Seattle.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's not as simple as you build an arena and then a team immediately comes back.
I mean, at this point, there haven't even really been smoke signals from the NBA that they're willing to consider expansion.
Well, I don't think expansion is what you should be thinking about at this point.
And the value of franchises has increased to an otherworldly level in that time period where who knows if there'll be franchises that are for sale and are willing to move. It's going to be a long process.
Yeah.
We have to look at the situation and think to ourselves that there probably will be another 10 years without a basketball team in Seattle.
I think I would probably take the under on 10 years at this point.
You're a cockeyed optimist.
I always have been. It's true. I would have probably taken the under on 10 years. I would have definitely taken the under on 10 years in early 2013 when it looked like a team was imminently coming to Seattle. But such is life. Such is life.
Well, my life's great. I have no grievances.
On the plus side,
everything's perfect.
We do have an NFL team. And that NFL team had a very impressive victory against the New York Football Giants on Sunday. Despite the fact that they were scoreless most of the first half, still ended up dominating on the scoreboard almost as much as they did in terms of point yards per play.
Are we toasting to that?
Yeah. Come on. I mean, a 17-point road victory in the Eastern time zone, even if it wasn't a 10 a.m. start, that's still worth toasting.
A game that could have been a 31-point road victory or more. But from that game, I want to toast also to Pete Carroll for going for it on that fourth down. It wasn't successful, but in the end, ended up being an excellent decision, and you have to trust that process.
An anti-grievance to that. I was noting on Twitter that what I like
I wish that he would tell Chris Peterson a thing or two.
Yeah, that's going to be our grievance for a second week in a row. Coach Pete not going for fourth down. What I liked about it is that Pete Carroll, you know, he didn't necessarily say, hey, the math supports this decision. But so much of the time when coaches talk about the situational factors and like how you have to take into the game context into account, usually that's explaining why they made a suboptimal decision.
Yeah.
In this case, it was explaining why he made an aggressive optimal decision based on those factors of the defense playing as well as it was. And, you know, thinking that you're going to get the ball back with good field position, even if you don't manage to score. And also the play call was great because they got Jimmy Graham isolated one-on-one in a play that worked for a touchdown later in the game. In this time, he just was unable to catch
up. We're so close to having our grievance be just Jimmy Graham.
Look,
he redeemed himself a lot in that game.
I'm Team Jimmy.
I'm Team Jimmy?
Sticking with Jimmy, thick and thin. Sticking with him through the drops, just like I stuck with Jermaine Kearse last year. And look at how well that worked out for the
Seahawks. When Jimmy Graham is on the Jets, two tight end set, ASJ and Jimmy Graham, you're going to be sticking with him. No, he'll be fine. Jimmy Graham will be fine. The thing is that people talk about the fade in the goal line, right?
Don't talk about the fade.
The Seahawks finally have figured out, not a fade, but you get Jimmy Graham lined up one-on-one, and you don't throw the ball high. You just throw the ball to Jimmy Graham, and he's going to catch it. Or he's not going to catch it, but he'll have a chance to catch it.
Well, just you let him post up, basically.
I mean, that's the play. The fade is a bad throw. Pass to Jimmy Graham is a good throw. And it's now worked two out of three times this season.
Yeah.
which is 2 out of 3 more times than they attempted it in previous seasons. I mean, you know, I get like the sentiment on Twitter. I think possibly former third Pelton brother Danny Kelly may have tweeted this. Like, why did it take?
He's still a third Pelton brother. Wait, you know
what I'm saying? Oh, well,
you're a third Pelton brother forever. All right, when you're fair. A third Pelton brother.
That, you know, why did it take 3 years for them to do this? But you know what? I'm not going to worry about the fact that it took them 3 years to do this. I'm just going to be glad that they finally did it at all, because it looked like they might never.
It's happening now. We're in that era.
Yeah. This is the Jimmy Graham era.
The Jimmy Graham era involves him dropping a pass from the one and dropping a wide open pass. People are saying that would have been a touchdown. I'm not so sure about that.
I don't think it would have been a touchdown, but it certainly would have advanced the ball many yards.
Yes.
I guess the one negative out of this game is we did see a couple of injuries. CJ Procise leaving early in the game when he tweaked his ankle. Sounds like there's a chance he'll get back to play this week, but ongoing durability issues. That's with just CJ Procise. The good news here is that JD McKissic has proved every bit as useful as CJ Procise in that role, and the more JD McKissic, the better.
Yep. I don't think we miss CJ Procise, especially not in the same way that we did last year, where it's like,
right,
when Procise was out, there was a hole there. And JD McKissic has made it that we just feel confident when he's in the game.
Yeah, last year it was CJ Spiller in that role. And this year they've realized that they don't necessarily need a running back named CJ to be their third down back. Mm-hmm. They just need a running back with initials.
Yes.
Just got to have one of those. Justin Britt, unlikely to practice until Friday this week is the word, but team still expects him to play. We also saw in that game that Mark Lewinsky and Ethan Posick shared time at left guard. It sounds like that's probably going to continue again this week, assuming that Britt plays, because otherwise Posick would be needed to fill in at center. Even though the consensus was that Posick was the more effective of those two players, according to those people who viewed the game tape, including loyal listener, third Pelton brother, Ben B. That's important because we did find out after we potted last week that Luke Jokel, following his knee scope, will miss 4 to 5 weeks. So it's going to be an extended period of time here for the Seahawks, filling in at left guard with someone else for Luke Jokel.
I thought you were going to say that Ethan Posick was still not going to play, despite the fact that he looked much better.
I mean, he's not going to play exclusively.
He looks like he's moved up to maybe the number one spot on the depth chart, though. This perhaps. We could be in the Posick era.
Oh, what an era. Posick era sounds a little bit like one of the dinosaur periods.
Yes.
Like they went from the Posick to the Cretaceous.
Yes.
In better injury news, Jeremy Lane back at practice this week, although not as a starter. Not as a starter, as he tweeted about losing his job on an off day, or getting benched, I should say, on an off day. And I got to tell you, I have no sympathy for Jeremy Lane here, because the Seahawks are always competing. That whole notion that you don't lose your job because of injury, that has always struck me as complete BS.
That tweet was such a good opportunity for Pete Carroll. He must have loved that.
A really cool opportunity.
A really cool opportunity for him to talk about how the team is always competing.
Yes.
I mean, really, it said nothing positive about Jeremy Lane. Nobody thought any better about Jeremy Lane because of it. And it gave Pete Carroll an opportunity to say to the rest of the team that they're always competing.
So Shaq Griffin, with one of his better performances against the Giants, had a couple of penalties late in this game, but before that did a really effective job. And I think we've also seen that Justin Coleman has really grown into that nickel
role. Love Justin Coleman.
Sure tackling there, which is really important in that position, and excellent coverage. I feel very comfortable with him in that spot.
Yes.
So that's the challenge for Jeremy Lane now.
Kind of amazing that the Patriots couldn't find a spot for Justin Coleman.
Well, their defense is so good. Why would they need to? Deion Jordan,
they've got the smoke or the fog. The fog is like the 12th man.
that's their nickel cornerback is the fog. Deion Jordan,
the fog is their big dime.
Yeah. Shout out to the big dime. Nice to see that in action. Even if Bradley McDougal failed to wrap up,
he missed one tackle. It's fine.
One long play. Deion Jordan off the NFI list and has resumed practicing. The Seahawks will have 3 weeks to decide whether to activate him. Not quite yet for Deshaun Shedd and Malik McDowell, although both of them sounds like working closer to a potential return.
I love the idea that we're that excited about Deion Jordan coming back. Considered a massive bust, he's basically just like a very, very long flyer that they brought in.
Yes.
But now we're like imagining that he's going to contribute to the team.
I would not go so far. It was just something I was mentioning.
But I mean, there are people who expect Deion Jordan to contribute.
Well, then maybe they aren't expecting to contribute. Dwight Freeney, who the Seahawks signed this week. I was all prepared to be like really down about the Seahawks signing Dwight Freeney because he's 37 and had just 3 sacks last season. But then I looked at the stats and it turned out that Dwight Freeney actually like is a good buy low candidate. So it turns out Freeney had 29 hurries last year playing for the Atlanta Falcons, which is an incredible total. It was not far outside the top 20 in the league, according to Football Outsiders Almanac.
Why was he not on a team before this?
I mean, I think he talked about having interest from other teams, but he was probably
37 years old,
who he wanted to play for. So on average, players have a sack for every 2.75 hurries that they get.
Okay.
So that would have translated into more than 10 sacks.
Wow.
For Dwight Freeney, which is not far off what he did the previous season in Arizona in 2015, where he had 8 sacks in just 11 games with 17 hurries. So I don't think you necessarily expect him to play quite as well because there is a significant amount of age-related decline when you're 37. But
he was 36 last year.
Yeah, I know. But there's reason to believe that he can be a very effective pass rusher for the Seahawks used in a situational role like he will be. So I'm excited about this.
I mean, it's kind of amazing to be able to bring him in at this point, to be able to replace Cliff Averill, who granted he's not going to be Cliff Averill.
No.
But they also have Frank Clark.
Right.
And have done a pretty effective job of replacing Cliff Averill on that defensive line, who again looked good.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he was missed last week. We saw great interior pressure from Sheldon Richardson and Jaron Reed. A toast to Jaron Reed.
Oh,
how
man.
Good
what
is Jaron Reed? Man. A strong performance there on the other side.
But we need to talk about Dwight Freeney again for 1 second.
Okay.
The Seahawks, for the second consecutive year, bringing in a classic player from the early 2000s.
Yeah.
You remember the Devin Hester run?
It was a good run.
It was a glorious run.
Especially in that playoff game in Atlanta. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to see the Hall of Famers get the Seahawks there as the last line on their plaque.
This might be a trivia question in the future.
It could be, yeah. If you're going to Seattle Sports Trivia, would we do that down the road? Be prepared, Dad, to answer about Dwight Freeney.
Just remember the name Dwight Freeney, although he could be playing again next year. But also, I mean, what are they paying Dwight Freeney? The veteran minimum?
I can't recall seeing a report, but I would assume so.
Why not? I mean, really, what do you stand to lose there by bringing somebody in and getting more defensive line depth?
Yeah, I mean, they had the roster spot open. They didn't fill it last week after placing Averill on IR. So, yeah.
I mean, this is not like an offensive player where you need to get them the ball, where they're going to take a percentage of snaps. He's basically just out there as part of a very big rotation and will have a chance to get in there and rush the quarterback. And if he does something, great. And if he doesn't, you really haven't spent that much money.
Right. We did see Bob Condotta tweet on Wednesday night that the Seahawks are working out Demontre Moore, who was part of the defensive end rotation last season and could be back after he was released by the Cowboys. And what they said was a football-related decision after he raised his fist at the end of the national anthem, seemingly in defiance of what Jerry Jones had to say about players respecting the national anthem.
He didn't kneel. And then he was released right after.
Yeah. Huh. Funny. Weird.
Man, I can't wait for Dak to do that.
Yeah, I think you'll be waiting for a while. All right, should we turn to the other side? Where there is an important addition this week. The Texans getting back Dwayne Brown, their left tackle, from his holdout that cost him the first 6 weeks of this season. There was talk, of course, about the Seahawks potentially trading for him. We talked about why that wasn't realistic, and now that clearly is not happening as he's returned to the team.
So what do you think the chances are that he plays on Sunday?
It sounds like he's going to, is the talk.
What percentage of Dwayne Brown do you think Dwayne Brown will be on Sunday?
I don't know. It'd be a complete wild guess to say.
For him, this is the first preseason game.
Yeah.
I mean, he's Dwayne Brown. So he's a professional.
It is for Cliff Averill, too. Or not for Cliff Averill.
Dwight Freeney.
For Dwight Freeney, too.
Yeah, but we're not counting on Dwight Freeney. He's not going to be playing every single down.
Right. That is significant.
Dwayne Brown, and granted it matters maybe a little bit less, although Deshaun Watson does take quite a few sacks. Dwayne Brown would be there every single play protecting Deshaun Watson's blind side. Dwight Freeney's playing 10 snaps, maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a different beast altogether. So, I mean, the Seahawks would probably be better off with Dwayne Brown not being there, but him being there, we can't expect that he's going to be immediately at Dwayne Brown level.
Right.
So the Texans are 3-3 this season, but their record is pretty wildly misleading. They're actually 7th in Football Outsiders DVOA, 3 spots ahead of the Seahawks, who moved up to 10th with their win over the Giants. And something that surprised me is that that's really more about the defense than it is the offense. As excited as they've been with Deshaun Watson taking over at quarterback, they rank 12th so far in offensive DVOA and 6th in defensive DVOA, despite losing J.J. Watt, Whitney Mercilus, and Brian Cushing. Basically, their 3 biggest name players, well, 3 of their 4, I guess, with Jadeveon Clowney still active, 3 of their 4 biggest name players on defense.
But you have to bring in a caveat.
And what's that?
They've played 1 game since those players have been out.
Yes. That is
in the game that they were injured, I think they gave up 42 points to the Chiefs.
That is
by
correct.
Far their worst defensive performance of the year.
And their 1 game they played since then was against the Cleveland Browns.
It was against the Cleveland Browns and Kevin Hogan.
Yes.
So I don't think you can just assume that this is what the Texans' defense is.
Nonetheless,
because they haven't really played any games against legit NFL opponents without J.J. Watt and Whitney Mercilus.
Nonetheless, it was surprising to me because of the fact that that was the game I've watched of Houston, was that Kansas City game. I guess I saw a little of Cincinnati on Thursday Night Football, and therefore most of what I've seen is like their offense scoring a bunch of points to try to catch up in that game, and their defense giving up a lot of points. So it didn't quite fit what I was used to. Let's start with Deshaun Watson, who leads all NFL quarterbacks in QBR 5 starts into his career.
He's so good.
He's incredible.
I mean, there's almost nothing even that you can say about Deshaun Watson.
I mean, there's a little you could say. He at times is inconsistent. You saw that
not about bad things.
Oh.
I'm saying, like, as far as glowing reviews of Deshaun Watson, because for somebody who has played in 6 NFL games, to be this good, it's unheard of. We knew that he would come in a little bit more polished than maybe some other quarterbacks. He just won the national championship game.
Yeah, but not so polished that they could start him in week 1 over Tom Savage.
Yeah, not.
Macho Man Tom Savage.
But right now, if you redrafted the NFL draft, he's the number 1 pick.
Yeah.
I would take him. I would take him over Dak Prescott. I would take him over Carson Wentz. I would take him over any quarterback who has come out in the draft since Russell Wilson.
You wouldn't take him over Russell Wilson, if you're being honest here?
No. I mean, Russell has had seasons that were this good.
He's had season that was this good. 2015.
I would not take him over Russell. But Deshaun Watson in these 6 games has been unbelievable. But
yeah.
if are there negatives that we can talk about?
Yeah, I mean, he at times is inconsistent with his passing. We saw this in the first half of the Kansas City game where his accuracy was way off. So his completion percentage, 61.5%, is not great. I was surprised that he's not as high as I would have expected in terms of yards per completion or even yards per attempt. But part of the reason he ranks number 1 in QBR is, of course, that incorporates rushing value, and he's 4th among QBs in rushing DR, despite playing, you know, 5.5 games. And then another interesting thing here is the Texans have drawn 151 yards on pass interference penalties. Only Pittsburgh with 157 has drawn more, and I think Pittsburgh has not had their bye yet. So on a per-game basis, the Texans are number 1. DeAndre Hopkins alone has drawn 7 pass interference penalties in 6 games. That's wild.
Yeah, I don't really understand how that's happening.
So they've taken it to another level, I think, really, since Will Fuller came back to play opposite DeAndre Hopkins, who is 4th in the NFL in DR. And it turns out DeAndre Hopkins is really amazing when he has a real quarterback playing with him.
Ugh.
But Will Fuller, since
I'm shaking my fist for being a fantasy owner of DeAndre Hopkins last year.
Been there, bro. Will Fuller has offered that big play threat. He's averaging 19.3 yards per reception, 5 touchdowns in 3 games, and he also has drawn a 45-yard pass interference penalty. And then kind of the third, it's kind of a 3-headed monster of receiving. It's those 2 wide receivers, and then also Lamar Miller out of the backfield, who ranks 3rd among running backs so far in receiving DR. That's a little surprising for someone who's not known as kind of an air back or, you know, a pass-catching specialist.
It's going to be a long week. But so bringing it back to Deshaun Watson and looking at some of the past defenses that they've faced, some good teams in New England and Kansas City. But if you're looking at where the past defenses that they've faced, especially in their last 4 games, which I think only New England was on the road, and then they've had 3 in a row at home, he's faced the number 26 pass defense, the number 19 pass defense, the number 24 pass defense, and the number 28 pass defense.
I'm surprised. So Kansas City is number 24 in pass
defense?
Kansas
City is number 19.
Okay, that makes more sense. Eric Berry certainly has been missed for them. They have some great cornerbacks.
So they're facing, all of these were bottom third pass defenses except for Kansas City.
Yes. And all of them were bottom half pass defenses.
The two times that he's faced above average pass defenses have been his two worst games of the year. One of them came in at halftime, and Jacksonville is an insanely good pass defense.
There, I don't know if you saw this, in terms of, I believe that was Pro Football Reference's adjusted yards per attempt. They're below 4 yards per attempt, which would be the first team since the 2013 Seahawks, rather, to get that,
yes,
that low.
They're historically great pass defense at this point. But the two times that he's faced above average pass defenses have been Deshaun Watson's worst two games of the year, and his yards per attempt were much lower than they were in these four games.
Now, the thing we need to discuss here is, again, as we mentioned, the ability, the value he generates as a rusher. So the Texans rank third in the NFL in rushing yards per game. They're sixth in yards per carry, and somehow they're 23rd in DVOA. I don't quite understand how this works, especially because nobody individually, like, Watson has been great. Miller has only been kind of average, which again is not, like, when I've seen him, he's mostly just been ripping off huge runs in the read option, taking advantage of the threat that Watson poses. But he's only averaging 3.8 yards per carry. He does rank 8th in Football Outsiders success rate, which indicates that he's been very consistent on a per play basis. We just haven't necessarily seen the big plays from him. That's where he's lacking.
Still doesn't make sense why they'd be 23rd in DVOA though.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't quite get that. So on the other side of the football, Texans impressively in the top 10 in both pass defense DVOA and rush defense DVOA. And it's interesting that, you know, despite the fact that they have Clowney and Watt, who did not have a sack before he was injured and lost for the season, they're only middle of the pack, 13th in adjusted sack rate. Clowney is the only guy with more than two sacks. He's got three. Their middle linebacker, Bernardrick McKinney, has two. No one else has more than one sack on the team. What they've really done well here is that they have shut down running backs and tight ends coming out of the backfield. And then they've also shut down number one cornerbacks, with Jonathan Joseph doing a really good job there. Where they've struggled is against every wide receivers that aren't number their team's number one wideouts. They're 31st out of 32 in DVOA against number two wideouts and 25th against other wideouts. And one factor in that is they've been without Kevin Johnson because of a sprained MCL he suffered in week two. So they've really been thin at quarterback. It looks like he's going to be back this week, returning from that injury.
Which will be an interesting thing to keep our eye on. Which will be an interesting thing to pay attention to. But I do think that, again, this is a place where the Texans are a weird team, right? They're a weird team statistically, but I think this is a place where, and I know that Football Outsiders adjusts for the strength of schedule, but when they've gone against good passing attacks, they've given up a lot of yards. And when they've gone against bad passing attacks, they've been really good.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that the good passing attacks would be ones that would really have the depth to take advantage of that weakness at cornerback.
But like 300 plus yards against both the Chiefs and the Patriots, 450 total yards against the Chiefs.
So another area of weakness for Houston has been, they're 22nd ranked overall in special teams, and you can almost entirely attribute the fact that they're below average to their punts. And this is despite the fact that Shane Lechler has averaged 50.1 yards per punt, but it's kind of a classic case, I think, of the punter who outkicks their coverage. Opponents have averaged 14.2 yards per punt return against Houston, including Tyreek Hill's 82-yard touchdown in that Kansas City game that was a big play, certainly. So this is, it would be nice to see Tyler Lockett get going in the
rushing
game.
Oh, man, it would be nice. Would love to see Tyler Lockett get one here. Should have had a touchdown in last week's game, but would love to see Tyler Lockett get going in the return game, something we haven't seen in quite a while.
So I guess the question about this game from like a big picture standpoint is, do we think it's actually going to be the shootout I have envisioned in my head?
No.
Really?
And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I just don't think that there will be enough possessions for it to seem like the shootout that you have in your head.
So you think that both teams are going to run the ball effectively, long drives?
I think they'll be long drives. Let's slow down before I say run the ball effectively.
Okay, you think that Houston is going to run the ball effectively? And the Seahawks are going to control pass effectively?
Yes, I can see the Texans getting into quite a few third and 7, 8, 9 situations, and then the Seahawks, because of partially Deshaun Watson's rushing ability, giving up third downs, Houston staying on the field more than we'd like them to be on the field. But then also on the other end, I mean, what we saw from the Seahawks last week was very encouraging, especially what they did on third down. Not only just being so successful on third down, but what they were looking for on third down. It felt like this was the first time all season that we've kind of seen the Seahawks offense as it looked when it was really good, just right. finding those players open on third down that should always be open, and they were.
And we also saw better pass protection last week. I don't think we really talked about that. Reese Odhiambo only allowing, I think, one pressure. That was outstanding. And yeah, I mean, I think it was the best offensive performance of the season, even though it only generated 24 points.
So I think we could see this as an old school Seahawks game where you can't really tell how good each of the offenses is playing because they're not putting up a ton of points. There might be a bunch of field goals in it, but they're going to be pretty efficient and stay on the field, but it's not going to be the shootout that you're envisioning.
So one thing I wanted to look at, because we're both so terrified of Deshaun Watson running, and you know, I think we have this play again in our head of, you know, it's third and long.
Yep.
Seahawks have great coverage.
Yep.
And then they lose contain in terms of their pass.
And Aaron Rodgers runs for like 17 yards.
But it actually turns out not to be as true as I thought. So I went on back and looked at the Seahawks.
Wow.
Theatrical. I went back and looked at the Seahawks against the elite running quarterbacks they've faced over the last 5 years. So Colin Kaepernick, Cam Newton, the aforementioned Aaron Rodgers, and then last year Tyrod Taylor. And so those players against the Seahawks defense, they have averaged 6.2 carries per game for 29.7 yards.
Man,
it's really not that many. 4.8 yards per carry, which is good, and it's probably been more timely runs than it has been.
Yes.
Other than, you know, Kaepernick had a couple of really huge games against the Seahawks. He had 11 for 130 in the NFC Championship game, and then 9 for 87. I believe that was in a Seahawks win. That was not in the loss where he had the run
the
to
sweep
seal
to
it.
Win the
that,
game.
That game he only had 9 carries.
That play still
for 31
haunts me.
Yards. Yeah, it'll always haunt you.
I think that is the reason that we imagine this, though, is you feel like you're getting off the field.
Right.
And you can see it's like third and long. The defense is playing well. They have everything covered. And then we just let somebody run it because they've gone too far downfield and we don't have a spy there.
Yeah.
With Deshaun Watson, I don't think that's going to be the case.
Colin Kaepernick.
We've got 37-year-old Dwight Freeney.
Oh, yeah. Colin Kaepernick, the only quarterback in this group to have more than 43 rushing yards against the Seahawks.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think that those plays are probably more devastating than they are frequent.
That's probably true.
So,
okay, all this being said, chances of victory in this game?
It's such a hard game to get a feel for.
It is. I agree with you.
Because I could obviously imagine a game where Deshaun Watson does Deshaun Watson stuff from the last few weeks. He's able to draw pass interferences. Will Fuller gets open because of a missed assignment or something. He's picking up third downs by running the ball. But then also, I think to myself, Earl Thomas is out there. Like, are we that afraid of the deep threat?
Probably not.
Probably not. That means that what this game could come down to is, what is Lamar Miller going to do? And I really believe that the Seahawks rush defense is in a much better position. And then, can they get off the field in those third and long situations? And I think they'll probably do just enough of it. I don't think they're going to score a ton of points either. Not necessarily because this is an amazing Texans defense, but that's just never the way it works.
It very rarely is.
So I think the Seahawks will probably do just enough. And, you know, maybe the Texans outgain them, but the Seahawks win the game.
That wasn't actually a chance of victory.
And I'm going to say the chance of victory is 65%.
That's where I was going to. So I don't know if that makes me feel better or worse that we're on the same page here.
We're going to lose. You're going to have to buy a lot of copies of Shea Serrano's book.
Yeah, that vow's out there. I'm sticking to it.
Well, of course you're sticking to it.
Yeah, it just was a thing to say.
Honestly, I don't think that there's been any player who the Seahawks have played, maybe save for Aaron Rodgers, who has scared me more than Deshaun Watson.
You should have been more scared of Tyrod Taylor last year, who did very nearly come into Central League Field. I thought it was interesting. I was reading the Texans game notes, as one does, and no AFC team has beaten the Seahawks in the Russell Wilson era. Or at home. I'm sorry,
in Seattle. I remember one loss to an AFC team. Yes. Russell Wilson here.
You can think of one. Yeah, that was one.
That's really interesting, though. No AFC team has beaten the Seahawks at home. The
Buffalo
Russell
came very close to doing it last year. But yeah, no team
I mean,
has.
Pittsburgh came very close. There were some good...
Pittsburgh didn't do that. Came that close. Pittsburgh wasn't that close. They've also had a tendency to often play like really terrible AFC teams at home. It's mostly like the Jets.
They played the Jets a lot of times.
The Titans when
Ryan Fitzmagic is the quarterback. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, and it makes me feel no better about this game.
Yeah, it shouldn't. It really has no bearing on this game. It was just an interesting note. All right. On that note, thanks for listening.
I'm just excited to watch this game.
Yeah, it should be
so
a fun
excited.
One. Unless the Seahawks lose. And actually, as soon as the game starts, it'll be terrifying. It won't be fun at all.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to have any fun at all.
Toughen up, says Pete Carroll.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.